Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. This is Justin Brierley, your host for the show that brings different points of view together for dialogue and debate every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio and listen to around the world as a podcast. You can find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and got a very special edition of the programme today as I air the audio from a dialogue I hosted in Canada recently. I'll be explaining the circumstances, the event and all the people I was privileged to meet while I was out in Canada recently. And huge thanks to Andy Steiger, Nancy Steiger, Steve Kim, and all the others who were involved in helping to make the Apologetics Canada conference and bringing myself over and my wife as well for this year's conference. Really wonderful experience. But if you're here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio this afternoon, then the programming will continue after Unbelievable with The Profile, when I'm sitting down with Dr. Nigel Cameron, who's an expert in not only bioethics, but also artificial intelligence and robotics. He's recently written a book on that from a Christian perspective. Listen to my conversation with him between 4 and 5 this afternoon. And don't forget, you can download the Profile podcast in its own right as well. Well, our early bird offer is finally over. Unless you're listening to this before it goes out officially on air, you're listening to the podcast on Friday, you might still just get time to get in for the early bird offer for Unbelievable, the conference 2018. But gosh, the tickets have been flying out in the last couple of days as the early bird offer has drawn to a close. But if you want to find out more about the conference and indeed, of course, booking at the standard rate from now on, you can go to our website, premier.org.uk/Just Ask. It's all happening, of course, on Saturday, the 19th of May. Wonderful lineup of speakers. We're doing it in partnership with Reasons to Believe. We're going to be releasing more information on the seminars, on the questions that we're going to be addressing, and the fact that you can ask the questions as well this year, because we've got a special way of you being able to do that coming up, where you can vote on some of the top issues, objections, questions that you'd like to see our guests at this year's conference address. Again, premier.org.uk/Just Ask. Just Ask is the theme of this year's conference. Now, I'm sure it won't have escaped your notice that there was a notable death this last week. Stephen Hawking died at the age of 76, one of the world's most famous scientists and physicists, responsible for certain theories involving Big Bang cosmology, and a name that frequently popped up on this show. Never got to speak to him in person, of course, but his name was often associated with issues around science and faith. He was a self-professed atheist, didn't believe that the universe required a explanation outside of itself for the cause of its existence. And that, of course, stimulated a lot of debate and dialogue over the years. We will be addressing the ideas of Stephen Hawking in forthcoming programmes, but I was able to share a little bit of my admiration for him, wherever he landed ultimately on the God question, on my Facebook page this last week, sharing a quote from him about the importance of looking up at the stars and trying to understand our place in the universe. I think we can all agree on that. So if you've got any thoughts in relation to the passing away of Stephen Hawking this last week, do get in touch. You can email in the show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can send me your thoughts via the Facebook and Twitter as well, @unbelievablejb for Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page. Today on the show, you're going to be hearing a live edition of Unbelievable that took place at the Apologetics Canada Conference in Abbotsford, British Columbia. It was a huge privilege to be out in the Vancouver area for around a week, in fact, to both deliver seminars at the Apologetics Canada Conference to preach at a local church in Vancouver, Village Church, and also to meet many of the listeners of the show who are out on the west coast of Canada and North America. I met many people when I was able to sign books after speaking at the conference, as well as meet pastors at a gathering of pastors before the conference began, and indeed to host this dialogue as well. It was lovely also to be able to visit some of the local area. Got time with my wife. Yes, we actually left the kids at home, believe it or not, for the week, which has not happened in a very long time, I can assure you. But we had a wonderful week together, actually, visiting friends on Vancouver Island, exploring Vancouver itself, downtown, etc. Even getting a day at the ski resort in Whistler. So we were able to explore some of the delights of the Vancouver area of Canada. You're unbelievable. But what you're going to be hearing today is the dialogue I recorded on the opening night of the Apologetics Canada conference on the subject of the foundation of human rights. Andy Bannister was our Christian guest, Justin Trottier, our humanist atheist guest on the stage at the Apologetics Canada conference, which had a 1,400 strong audience and lots of their questions, of course, towards the end of the dialogue too. Now, if you're listening via radio, you're just going to be hearing the actual dialogue that I hosted. That's all we've time for. But if you want the extended edition of today's show, do go to the podcast, where we're also going to be including the Q&A section that followed the dialogue. That's all available, as usual, from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And don't forget, Andy Bannister is one of the guest speakers at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2018, Just Ask, on Saturday the 19th of May. Go and check out what he'll be speaking about at our conference webpage, premier.org.uk/Just Ask. Wonderful speaker. Lovely to spend some time as well with Andy at the conference over that weekend. So here we go, coming up, the live edition of Unbelievable from Canada.
Wow. Thank you so much for that warm welcome. It's fantastic to be here tonight for this very special dialogue that we're hosting on the opening night of the Apologetics Canada event. I'm Justin Brierley, and as Andy said, I am part of a show that we call Unbelievable with a question mark that is hosted in the UK but is listened to around the world via podcast. And I just wondered, this is a terrible thing to ask, but has anyone listened to the Unbelievable show before? We've got a few hands.
Hey.
Great. That's great. Well, all of you guys are actually part of the Unbelievable show tonight, which is good, because we're recording tonight's event and we're going to broadcast it on our radio station in the UK and indeed podcast it around the world. So why don't we give a very big Canadian welcome to the international radio and podcast audience?
Hey!
Yes.
Wow.
Thank you. So welcome along to tonight's dialogue. It's on the Foundation for Human Rights, a Christian and Humanist in Dialogue. And it's a great pleasure to be joined on the stage tonight by Andy Bannister and Justin Trottier. Andy is director of the SOLAS Centre for Public Christianity in the UK and was also a one-time director of RZIM here in Canada. Andy is also the author of The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Terrible Consequences of Bad Arguments. Very highly recommended book, very funny book, actually. I think it's also available at the bookstand here. Justin Trottier is the CEO of the Canadian Association for Equality and has previously founded secular organisations such as the Freethought Association of Canada, which was behind Canada's very own atheist bus campaign several years ago. So Andy tonight is our Christian and Justin is our humanist. Can you give them both a very warm welcome? And I also want to welcome everyone who is watching via the live streaming venue. So welcome along. Thank you for joining us for tonight's event. I want everyone to feel part of this because we're actually going to be coming to you for your questions later on in the evening. So after we've had our dialogue here on the stage, we're going to be having a short break. And then it's your opportunity to ask the questions of my guests tonight. There's a few ways you can do that. There's going to be an opportunity to do that via SMS text. So we've got some details, I think, coming up on the screen about this. But you can text ACConf18 to 37607. There we go. To join the session. That's the way to do it via text. Or you can submit a question at the website, pollev.com/ACConf18. Or simply tweet your question if you're on Twitter to @apologeticsca. You can do that at any point in the evening. We're going to try and accumulate a number of those and feed those into the Q&A a little bit later on. There will also be microphones here in the auditorium set up on the side aisle so that if you want to come forward and ask a question yourself, then you can do that as well as part of the Q&A. And we'll go through the etiquette for that a little bit later on. Please do tonight, I'm sure you will do this anyway, but please do respect our speakers. No cheering or jeering during the conversation, except for Andy, that's fine. No, and please hold any applause until the end of the conversation when we can show our appreciation for everyone that's been involved. But for now, do again give a very warm welcome to Justin Trottier and Andy Bannister. Right. Well, it's really fun to be here and do this actually on stage. So thank you both, gentlemen, for agreeing to come on and do this live dialogue.
It's a pleasure.
Why don't we meet you both, first of all? So, Justin, this might be confusing. We're both Justins, but we'll try and... I was going to say, how did they end up with two Justins and two Andys at the same conference? But
intelligent design.
Who knows? Hey.
The battle of the bad jokes begins.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's your move now.
Please don't ask Andy to start joking about
it. It's all right. I'll keep calm and carry on.
Oh, dear. Right. So tonight we're asking, what are the foundations for human rights? It seems kind of fitting, actually, that we're doing this. I think it's the 70th year this year, the anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that's a significant anniversary in many ways, because I think it causes us to ask, why do we believe in the concept of universal human rights to begin with? And ultimately, I think the question we're going to be getting to tonight is, are such beliefs in the inherent dignity and equality of all human beings best grounded in Christianity or humanism? But before we get to all that, why don't we talk to you both about your background? So, Justin, you're a humanist. Tell us, what is a humanist to you, and what does that mean for your life?
I just first just thank everybody for being here tonight really quick, and also in particular to thank Apologetics and Steve, who I worked with in terms of coordinating my participation tonight. And they did an amazing job. They're extremely professional and well-organized, and I just really want to thank them for all
Absolutely.
That they did to get all of us here today. Also good to see Andy again. We've been at this a few times.
We have.
Here we go again. that wasn't to be funny, but it's really good to see Andy and to meet Justin as well.
And you still haven't convinced him yet. I mean, it's... Yeah.
Likewise.
Maybe next time, who knows. So I do call myself a humanist, but I should also say I call myself a number of other things. So I'm an atheist, I'm a free thinker, I'm a humanist... I'm also a secularist. Those sort of mean slightly different things. They're not inconsistent. They sort of touch on different elements of my identity. You asked about humanism. That is how I would describe my ethical understanding. Atheism is simply my lack of belief in God, or my belief that there isn't sufficient evidence to compel me to believe in God. And I'm a secularist politically. And I don't think that secularism is necessarily inconsistent, if it's political secularism, with either atheism or theism. I think you can agree that we want institutional neutrality, which is how I describe my secularism, regardless of what our beliefs are with respect to religion. So I'm sorry for that long-winded answer.
No, that's helpful. I mean, turning to the atheist label in that sense, does that for you imply anything about the way you understand the universe? I mean, presumably you don't believe there is any supernatural dimension to the universe. Would you subscribe to something like naturalism, the view that all that does exist is natural stuff, you know, matter in motion, the natural forces of the universe and so on?
Yeah, I think naturalism may be a better way to encapsulate my worldview. It's that I don't see that the burden of proof has been met by any religious community. So it's not that I'm anti-Christian or anti-Jewish or anti-religion even. It's just that without there being evidence, and to my mind there isn't compelling evidence for something as really complicated and as serious as a God, that's a serious claim, I think one should kind of withdraw or not consent to a claim unless there's sufficient evidence to compel one to believe it.
And do you feel that in that sense, the worldview of naturalism is the more compelling one for you in terms of the ones that are on offer out there?
Well, naturalism is simply the claim that the world exists and that reality is what it presents itself to us, what science can show us to be true through really just the tools that science has, which are an extension of our five senses. So I'm not sure that reality, other than if you're a solipsist, that you really need to convince anybody else. We can all kind of agree on that, at least. It's when we talk about metaphysics where there's room for disagreement. Sure. And that's where I might part ways with some of the other people in this room.
And when it comes to your humanism specifically, that is, as you say, more about the ethical concerns you have.
Yes.
And so why call it humanism specifically? Is it to do with the kind of ethics we come up with as humans, essentially?
So honestly, I would not choose that term. I'm just going to be really, really blunt about it. I'm not here really to defend really anybody else's worldview. I'm just going to talk about what my worldview is. So I am a humanist because I think that is kind of the closest we've gotten to the kind of ethical worldview that I espouse. But I think that label really perhaps needs to evolve somewhat because it is human-centered. And I would actually suggest that there are animal creatures out there, non-human animals, that are probably deserving of some basic rights, human rights. So that's why that human center term is limiting. So I would probably go a little bit beyond that. But basically, humanism is about the marriage of rationality and compassion. Those are sort of the pillars that I would try to bring together to describe what humanism is all about.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Justin,
for
this dialogue. Andy, welcome along as well. Tell
Great
us a little bit
here.
About yourself. You're obviously a Christian. Is that something that you've always been or adopted at some point? And what difference does that make to the way you live your life?
That's a great question, Justin. It's so confusing with two...
I'm sorry.
After JB and JT, and I'll talk about JC a bit.
Bieber, Justin
Justin
Trudeau.
Justin Bieber and Justin... Let's not go there. But just to actually echo Justin's comments, I mean, really grateful to all of you folks for coming out and joining us on a slightly damp Vancouver evening. And just a heads up, actually, if the three of us this evening are looking slightly tired, it's because this Justin and I were 8 hours off your time zone, and poor old Justin T on the end here had a 10-hour flight delay in Edmonton and got in about midnight last night. So all of us are sort of suffering slightly. So if we nod off during the dialogue, it's not that you guys are boring us. But to your question, Justin, so I'm a Christian. And my story is an interesting one. So I was raised in a kind of Christian home. And like I think many kind of Christian young people, certainly in my kind of sort of mid to late teens, really sort of found myself questioning like kind of what that really meant. And then particularly, I think what was interesting for me was in the sort of mid to late 1990s when I began really actually encountering and dialoguing with people who believed differently to me, particularly Muslims. In my case, some atheists, but also Muslims, really challenged me to ask some pretty profound questions about whether what I believed was true. And I think that's really ultimately what matters. And I think this is something that Justin and I will agree on this evening. What matters is what's true. And I found myself profoundly challenged to sort of face up to the question of, are the things that I've been raised in true? Or are they just sort of, sort of pious stories? Is Islam true? In which case, I guess I need to believe that. Or are none of these things true? In which case, I need to follow the evidence where it leads. And actually, that began my journey into academia and led me to be ever more convinced, actually, that Christianity is true. I think when I was in my teens, I probably believed because my parents did. I couldn't give you any reasons. Now I can give you, hundreds of hours of reasons why I think Christianity is true. And I think if it's true, it changes everything. And I think this is one of the interesting things that we may touch on this evening. That's actually interesting. If you read around human rights theory and philosophers who have written on it from both sides, actually you find many atheists and many Christians agreeing that actually everything changes if there is a God. Friedrich Nietzsche, famously kind of saw that, and others. So I think, on this question of human dignity, human value, human worth, I believe as a Christian that everything hangs on whether, material things are not just the only reality, as Justin put it.
Well, it's great to have those introductions to you both. In a sense, it could be argued that the concept of universal human rights is a relatively recent concept, historically speaking. As I say, 70 years this year since the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm just going to read just a section of the first article here, which was drafted 70 years ago. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Just before we get into sort of looking at the grounding and the foundations for all this, what for you is so important, in a sense, about having this kind of a universal declaration of human rights, Justin?
Well, I think you just read it. It's kind of there in the preamble, endowed with reason and conscience. And some people in the room might think endowed by God. I would argue endowed by the process of natural selection, endowed by evolution. That is, it's something that happened naturally, but whatever the origin is, the fact that we do have these special capacities to reason, to self-determination, to free will, and to acts of creativity, to, in other words, to be moral agents. We have all of the prerequisites to be moral agents. Means that we're both deserving of human rights protections, but it also comes along with responsibilities that other kind of free agents wouldn't have to bear. And the Human Rights Declaration, I think, was the culmination of actually thousands of years of history. So I would maybe dispute a little bit on whether it is new. It's certainly the first time we've come together as a planet and issued a declaration like that. But I think it is really the culmination or the climax of a number of trends, and not just Western trends. And we could look at, the Code of Hammurabi is often invoked as maybe one of the first sort of quasi-human rights style declarations back in the, I think it was the 17th century BC. Got the Magna Carta much more recently in Britain. So there are a number of sort of...
Staging posts.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. What for you is the significance of this, a declaration of universal human rights, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, a really good question. I think what fascinates me is, I mean, you obviously quoted from the preamble, but if you go a little bit even further back, I mean, the whole of the UDHR is really founded on this idea of human dignity and human value. That's the kind of language that's used there. And so I think I find this fascinating for two reasons. One is, of course, the question it raises, and that's the one we're going to get into this evening. But I think also that foundation that flows out of that, because I think really that is the question. You know, do each member of the audience here, do we actually have the inherent dignity, the inherent value that the UDHR talks about? If so, then exactly as Justin has said, so many things flow from there. And I'm glad that, you know, Justin, you mentioned responsibility as well, because often we just talk about human rights. I think we need to talk about responsibilities. So many things flow out of that. But of course, if we don't have that dignity, if we don't have that value, then all bets are off. So I think the UDHR does a wonderful job of, I think, focusing the spotlight on the key question. Mm. But what's interesting, and this is, I think, we're going to explore this evening, the UDHR doesn't give any reasons. I think that's been the critique of it. It uses words like, we have dignity, we have value, we have these innate things. And you read it, certainly, if you're an inquiring person, you go, wonderful, we need some evidence. As you said at the start, evidence is hugely important. And it sort of doesn't give it.
Right, which is it why just assumes it at assumes some it, level.
Which is why it opens up space for dialogues by this evening.
Well, but in a way, I think that's kind of potentially a good thing rather than a flaw. Because it does mean that however you've come to believe in the validity of human dignity or human rights as a way of defending that dignity, you can find the declaration to make sense to you. And different traditions will come up with different foundations. And even if you're a theist or you're an atheist, there are still going to be rival, you know, ideas about how do you lay the foundations for human rights. So it's not like the only debates between atheists and theists. Mm. Far from it. There is really interesting conversations happening in both of those camps. But by not really limiting itself, the declaration that is, to one particular foundation, it allows all of these multifaceted ways that we've arrived, some from the West, some from the East, for example, to all find a home in that declaration.
Do you believe that fundamentally undergirding all that is actually this evolutionary process which gives us this awareness of our shared reason, shared humanity, and so on, which seems to be what you said is what endows us with that conscience, that reason, and so on.
Right, but I'm not hinging on that. Right. I mean, what I am hinging on are the capacities that we have. Mm. You know, and I named a few before. You know, there's also capacities to feel pleasure and pain, capacities to, as I said earlier, sort of make responsible actions and then be held responsible for the actions that we make. Those are the sorts of qualities that are, if not uniquely human, certainly we have them in higher degrees than any other species. And so that's the shared common humanity that I think is the foundation for the universality of the human rights.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation. I think what's fascinating, though, is I think the fact that the framers of the UDHR, I think, quite deliberately steered away from that. That the foundation there that's chosen from is not so much those capacities. If you read the document, it flows out of the sense that the claim that we have this dignity, we have this value. And I think the interesting question is to actually ask whether you can ground that in every worldview. It's interesting, Justin, that you said, you know, there are, you know, different atheist perspectives, different Christian perspectives on this. Let me just read you a very, very brief line from Richard Rorty, a very well-regarded ethicist, postmodern liberal theorist, atheist. He wrote a little essay a few years ago called Postmodern Bourgeois Liberalism. And in that, these are his words as an atheist. He says, secular liberals like myself are effectively freeloading atheists. He says, we continue to rely on the Judeo-Christian legacy of human dignity, despite the fact we reject the revealed truth that could support that concern. And I think one of the questions I find interesting is whether actually, if you have metaphysical naturalism, that we are just this process of time plus chance plus natural selection. You can certainly talk about these wonderful faculties that we have, but whether you can actually say that you, that I, that Justin, that members of the audience have innate dignity, that becomes problematic, because innate dignity means actually you have dignity irrespective of your abilities. Mm-hmm. And of course this flows into, you know, sort of disabilities and rights and other kind of issues of going, somebody who's a human being who has none of those capacities due to, say, profound disability, the UDHR would say, no, just because you are human and for no other reason, you have dignity and value from which these things flow. I think that's the brilliance of the document. But that's also the question that it raises.
Well, I'm not going to sort of take up the mantle of any other atheist or anybody else for that matter. I'm not going to ask you to do the same thing. I'm not going to sort of quote Christians and ask you to defend their particular point of view. Lots of Christians say lots of different things. I think we can agree on that. But the issue, theoretically, is Christianity as a framework. Is it the right foundation? Is it a foundation? And if it is, I guess I would kind of ask a bit tongue-in-cheek, although not really, why did it take 2,000 years?
Yeah.
I mean, why is it that you have this event, if you believe it's a historical event, about Jesus' death on the cross, if that is what sort of brought meaning and human dignity into the world, as I think I've heard you argue,
yep,
then why did it take 2,000 years? Why did it happen in particular circumstances, notably the early modern period, the end of serfdom, the coming to fruition of scientific enlightenment values? Why was that the context where Christianity finally sort of brought us yeah, human rights? So why do you need to sort of wait for that to bear fruit?
Yeah. That's a brilliant question. So let's say a couple of things, actually. What's interesting, actually, is a piece of work just been done. And for folks who like Googling, I'll let you go Google this, that in Comparative Sociology, issue 17, which is the latest issue this year, has just done a paper, and they're looking at the whole question of, could the various certainly religious systems of the world be considered to be equally good foundations for human rights? And the conclusion is actually interesting, that's not the case. That it does seem to be the Judeo-Christian legacy has offered something. If we look around the world today, there are, you know, for example, when it comes to things like religious freedom, it goes really without controversy that it's largely Muslim-majority countries that come top of the list for religious freedom restrictions for a whole number of reasons. We could push into that. It would be an interesting conversation. But in terms of the historical piece, though, I want to say a couple of things here. I think you can certainly accuse the church at times of being slow of catching on. Certainly catching on to that idea, I think, built into the biblical revelation that Christians are made in the image of God. That's where the idea comes from in Christianity, that we have innate value. Genesis chapter 1 verse...
Or all people, in fact.
Or all people, actually. Yeah, I'm not saying just Christians. By people, I mean human beings. Christians actually got hold of that far more quickly than is actually given credit for. So, for example, it's interesting, if you look at pagan critics of Christianity in the first 200 or 300 years, what were Christians criticized for? Christians were criticized for the fact that they were including within Christian churches, alongside cultured Romans and Greeks, they were including slaves, women, children, all those classes of society that, interestingly, Aristotle, of course, believed were subhuman. Mm-hmm. And you have someone like Aristotle, absolutely brilliant philosopher, but mounted an amazingly persuasive argument, for his peers, that actually it's only men who enjoy the things that we've talked about. But the church cut right across that, And so around about 180, you find a, you know, critic like Celsus, pagan Roman, criticizing Christians for that. We come through the 6th century. You know, we find the first kind of anti-slavery arguments really coming to the fore. People like Patrick, St. Patrick in Ireland, you know, very early, often actually overlooked, actually. Everyone goes to feel like Wilberforce. But he was, you know, mounting a spectacularly quite successful anti-slavery campaign as early as the 600s. Has the church not been as quick on catching on some of this? I would actually take that critique on the chin and say I think at times Christians should have woken up to what's in their own tradition. But I think the question...
I'll wait until you're done.
Yeah, all I'd say, and I'll pass the baton back to you, I think to me the question isn't so much what Christians have or haven't done. The question that intrigues me is reality. I just want to keep focusing us on the question of, does Justin have, do our audience members have this evening, is this innate dignity that the UDHR talks about? Is it real? Is it actually a reality? Or is it just a sort of quasi-legal concept?
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to Unbelievable. This is a special live edition of the programme that was recorded at the Apologetics Canada conference recently. Thanks to Apologetics Canada for their wonderful hospitality in being able to make this particular event happen on the opening night of their event. And we'll be returning to this dialogue on the Foundation for Human Rights between my guests Andy Bannister and Justin Trottier in the next part of today's programme.
Welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the Unbelievable Show here on Premier Christian Radio and the podcast. Listen to around the world at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Airing a special edition of the programme, a live recording at Apologetics Canada when I sat down for an opening dialogue for the event with two guests, Andy Bannister and Justin Trottier, to talk about the Foundation for Human Rights. Just a reminder that Andy Bannister will be joining me and many others at Unbelievable, the conference 2018. Andy will be speaking on topics such as five tough questions, and those will actually be voted for by you, the listening audience, this year. Plus, he'll be talking on Islam as well, a Christ-like response to Islam, participating in a number of Q&A sessions and things. So do check him out and the various other speakers at this year's Unbelievable Conference event page, premier.org.uk/just ask. Still some fantastic ticket options available. Two or more tickets gets you last year's conference on DVD and CD. There are discounts for youth workers and students. There's also group discounts. Do check it out. premier.org.uk/just ask. So we're going to return to this conversation in the second part of today's programme as Justin Trottier, our atheist guest at this dialogue, begins to question Andy on how good the Christian record is when it comes to human rights.
Well, I do want to come back first, though, on something that you said, because
yes,
you were applauding the early Christian community with respect to sort of, as an example, including women in their meetings. And I guess I'm not going to tarnish every single thing that Christian communities have done. That's not my business. We were just talking about sort of the theoretical foundation. So I did give some examples where the church was kind of behind the times. I might also throw out the fact that the Pope, you know, was the one to oppose the Magna Carta. He believed it interfered with King John's divine right of kings, this great chain of being, which in the medieval world the church was pushing forward, rather regressive when you think about it from a modern point of view. So we can kind of trade that back and forth. But if we're just going to kind of talk about the early Christian community, we're going to talk about, let's say, women, for example. Paul in Ephesians, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, 5:22 says, "Wives, submit yourself to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church." We also know in Genesis that Eve was made from man. Man was made by God in the image of God. You're right about that, of course. But was woman made in the image of God? Or was woman made from man and then so man
a
named
of, couple
woman?
Of biblical ones. A biblical issues.
Well, the great thing is...
Well, I did my homework. So
no, that's great, Justin. Up, so. That's fantastic. Lucky I read a few bits of atheism as well. We should be...
I believe you wrote a book on it, actually.
I may have done, yes. And there were some pretty bad arguments out there. That was a moderately bad argument, respect, because Genesis 1, 26 and 27. Well, the great thing is, in reverse order, the image of God text in Genesis 1, 26, 27, which is central to, you know, sort of thinking about anthropology for both Jews and Christians, actually says, yes, in the image of God, he made them male and female, he created them. So actually, right there in the beginning. Ephesians is interesting, because if you read more widely in that passage, you'll also find it talks about mutual submission. It also goes on as well, which is often missed, to say to husbands that we are to love our wives as Christ loved the church. So I'm actually called to lay my life down for my wife. So if you read that passage carefully, it's actually quite a balanced argument about the responsibilities on both sides. And what's interesting about biblical texts, one of the challenges is we tend to forget we're reading them through 2,000 years or more, and we tend to read them through a Western lens.
Sure.
We tend to read back into that, because I know you're married as well, and so we tend to read back into that through the kind of relationships we have with our wives, and we take it for granted we love our wives. In the ancient world, it wasn't taken for granted as a Roman or Greek husband you loved your wife. In fact, usually the pattern was your wife was there for the raising of children, and you had a whole collection of, you know, mistresses and concubines on the side for the other kind of stuff. And the New Testament cuts right across that. And that, if you read the commentaries, scholars will tell you that was a pretty radical statement, again, for a Greek or a Jew, or even a Jewish husband to be hearing.
Yeah, and again, I'm not trying to knock everything, but I just want to say quickly, if we're going to avoid looking at 2,000 years ago through modern eyes, I think we might also, at the same time, realize sometimes we're perhaps interpreting things more positively in light of our modern sensibilities than maybe was actually there in the book originally.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's a couple of things going on here that's quite interesting, because I think we all have a tendency to do this with our own traditions. I think one of the things that both atheists and Christians can do, we can have a tendency to try and read our own tradition more positively and to read the other tradition more negatively. So it's actually very interesting. The other night we did an event like this down in Vancouver, and during the Q&A, somebody raised the issue of Hitler. Mm-hmm. And which was funny, because actually my humanist co-partner earlier in the evening had said, let's just agree that nobody mentioned Hitler this evening. And
I wish we had made that agreement earlier.
But what was great was Ian and I had this, actually ended up agreeing with each other and saying that I think, for example, that's a classic example, because Christians have a tendency to pick up the Third Reich and use it to whack atheists around the head with, and some atheists have a tendency to pick up Hitler and try and whack Christians around the head with him. And I think we can all have a tendency to try and read history in a way that benefits us and overlooks the mistakes of our community. What I would say is one of the things that's so, I think, incredibly exciting about really good biblical scholarship is we actually in some ways know far more about the ancient cultures today than we did even 50 years or 100 years ago, particularly without going down particularly this rabbit trail, but for example for the Gospels we now have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we know so much more about first century Judaism than perhaps any time in biblical scholarship.
If I could move the conversation on,
yes,
because we've a really interesting conversation sort of addressing this question of whether the Bible does sort of actually meet modern standards of what we would call universal human rights. I think the reverse question to you, Justin, is the question of whether a naturalistic viewpoint, specifically a sort of secular humanistic viewpoint, can ground these modern ideas of universal human rights. I mean, you've already said that you think you can get this from a sort of scientific grounding. So are these beliefs in the intrinsic dignity and equality of all humans, are they something that are discovered, that already exist in some sense out there, or are they things we essentially invent, we impose upon reality? And therefore, in that sense, they're to some extent subjective rather than objective.
So let me just first kind of clarify one thing. To say that I think that they're scientific isn't to say that they're going to be found in a laboratory,
sure,
but it is to say that whatever they are, they have to be consistent with what we do find in the laboratory. I mean, it wouldn't make much sense to impose on us requirements that are physically impossible, for example. So whatever kind of moral system we create, we as human beings have to be capable of actually, executing it or implementing it. So just to put that aside to your particular question, I don't think they're really either invented or discovered. I'm not sure I would describe them with either of those terms. They're not discovered because they don't really exist out there, like in a Platonic reality, like mathematical truths in that kind of sense. As I said, they're not going to be found in the laboratory. If a universe exists somewhere without rational or sentient creatures, then human rights wouldn't really be a meaningful concept. On the other hand, they're not invented in the sense of kind of an arbitrary or contingent kind of creation. I think instead they just sort of flow from human capacities. And that was, I think that was the first comment that I made, that it is because we have those capacities that, you know, this, whatever this thing is here.
really, it's a very cool wooden log table, yes, is what it is.
Whatever it is, it doesn't have those capacities. And you wouldn't expect God to just declare that this thing had human rights. You
sure,
what I'm saying?
There's something about that, it. That,
there's something
that gives
about it.
It
it's
rights.
Intrinsically got those capacities. It's something
how
random
do you,
can't
how
just
do you
be
determine
given
what does and doesn't have those rights then? Why do we ascribe them to humans and not to woodlouse or something else?
Well, I should say, I think perhaps we should be expanding them somewhat to some of the members of the animal kingdom.
Right.
I would, for example, consider, I'm not saying that, let's say chimpanzees, for example, may probably be the first species we would seriously look at. And in fact, there is a project right now that is seeking to bring a court case. I forget the jurisdiction, I think in New York State, where there are some chimpanzees that are being used for research. And the argument is being made that these chimpanzees are capable of some of the same things that we are, that they can feel pleasure and pain, that they know themselves, if they they can have actions that they commit themselves to, that they interact with other people in a way where you can play games with them and they will actually show some understanding of fairness in certain of these games. So some of these capacities may be the kinds of things where we want to explore, not giving them all the rights that we have, that would be absurd, but certain protections at least that they don't enjoy right now, such as imprisoning these conscious right. creatures.
So, Andy, Justin's saying that, okay, not exactly discovered or invented, but rather flowing from the capacities we have to experience pain and pleasure, to reason, to know ourselves, to be self-conscious in that sense. Why for you isn't that an adequate grounding for universal human rights?
I think two things I would say there. I think what's interesting is if one takes that route, I think it's worth it to start recognising what we're doing. We are at that point tearing up most of the early foundational work on human rights, the UNHDR and other documents, which quite consciously chose the kind of dignity, the innate value, you know, inalienable kind of sort of properties that flow out of being human. And again, sometimes, you know, for those of us who are perhaps non-philosophers, what do we mean when we say, you know, innate dignity? Well, again, it means that you have a dignity and a value that comes just because you're a human, just because you're a human, just because you're a human, not because of anything you can do. And I think the danger, once you then sort of throw that out and say, well, instead we're going to look for capacity, is you do hit this rather awkward question of what happens with human beings who don't have that capacity. And that's why the work that I think Andy Steiger and others are doing on the Human Project is quite interesting, because this whole dehumanization angle, dehumanization is a real threat right now. And if you look through history, it's always been the way that we've kind of sort of tried to sort of carve off and dispose of people we don't want around. You can't actually get rid of another human being. That's been demonstrated in history, actually. You know, humans don't tend to kill other humans. Humans tend to kill other people that they've labeled as something other than human. And if we think that's not going on today, well, it still is. There are parts of the world where that kind of labeling is still going on. If you look at what's happening around Down syndrome right now, for example. So I think once we start trying to locate it in capacity and ability and those kind of things, that raises the awkward question of what do you have if you don't have those capacities, is the
just
is the first
just expand
problem.
A bit on the comment you made about those with Down syndrome.
Yeah, so right now, for example, there's a move in many kind of countries. Some of the Scandinavian countries are sort of taking the forefront of this and saying, how can we sort of construct a world through, you know, various kind of biological means, through selective abortion, eugenics, other kind of bits and pieces, whereby, you know, we no longer have Down syndrome in our society. But as disability rights advocates have sort of talked about, they've gone, well, that's dehumanizing language. Because when we talk about we no longer want Down syndrome, what you actually mean is people who have Down's syndrome. And Down's is interesting because we have, you know, back in the UK, we have two
two families that we're very close friends with who have Down syndrome children, who would be adamant that's a type of person. That's actually a community that we're talking about here. But it's just that dehumanising language that we like to push people that we want to sort of treat in a way that perhaps we wouldn't treat others. The language begins first of all to try to recategorise them in a way that they don't belong like the rest of us. And I think interesting, they just end on this and then happily pass across. I mean, I think again. To quote someone from the atheist side, I mean, Sam Harris, very well-regarded atheist, it's quite interesting here, and he wrote on this whole issue of capacity, and he said the problem with going down the capacity route is if you draw those capacities too tightly, then you do start excluding vast numbers of the human community, the very, very young, the very, very old, those who are profoundly disabled, and if you draw them too loosely, then you do start drawing in all other kind of things. I mean, it's not so much the issue, perhaps, of the great apes, but you start drawing in all kinds of life, you know, rats and aardvarks and lettuces and so on and so forth. So Sam, I respect his honesty in going, it's a real problem where you draw the boundaries. But if Sam were here, I'd say...
I mean, do you want to respond?
It is a real problem, but that's why my reaction to that problem is to go the other route, not to dehumanize. Those are horrifying stories that you're talking about, dehumanizing people with Down syndrome, but to humanize more non-humans, perhaps, and not just chimpanzees or other animals. What about if we encounter alien intelligence? It might sound kind of speculative, but those are not humans, but they're persons in a philosophical sense. Should we not be expanding protection and, of course, the same kind of rights to them? What about where we're going with artificial intelligence? We were talking backstage about this potential possibility. If ever we could realize such far-fetched things like downloaded consciousnesses, would we not want to expand protection and rights there too? So I would rather actually go the other route and humanize more things than fall into this trap of potentially going the other way and dehumanizing.
What I find really fascinating about that, Justin, is the moment you start using the term humanizing, it's almost actually that you are inherently recognizing what the founders of the UDH are recognizing. There is something special about humankind. There is something, and a word that's interesting actually, as I was doing a lot of reading preparing for tonight and the dialogue on Wednesday, and reading sort of quite widely in some of the literature, and as you say, there are atheists, secular humanists, as well as Christians who've written widely on this. The word that almost everybody uses is the word sacred. I came across a lot of the atheist writers who talk about human life being sacred. And I think that's interesting that it's almost a tacit admission there that we would extend the circle of humanity to include others. And again, that brings us back to the question I think we're dancing around. Is there something actually inherently valuable about human beings? Were the founders of the UDHR correct? And if so, but what's going
from
on
from a
there?
Christian point of view? Oh,
I was going to ask, are you happy to use that language of there being something intrinsically valuable about humans?
Of course. Well, about those creatures who have the natural capacities that I described. And I do want to come back, because you did, you know, kind of put me in the spotlight about capacities.
Yes.
And it's a fair question to ask. I guess my response would be, we're talking about those things which have these natural capacities, not that they're always being realized. I mean, when we go to sleep, for example, we're not exercising rational thought, but nobody would think that suddenly we don't deserve human rights because we're temporarily unconsciously asleep. That would be ridiculous. If we're in a coma, for example, we're still beings that have the abilities to have all those capacities.
My wife would say that the volume I snore at, I have definitely given up some rights when I sleep, but that's another discussion.
I mean, I'd be interested to know, though, so, for instance, in the issue with, say, a child with Down syndrome, they may not have the same types of capacities as a child of equivalent age who doesn't have that. But I think Andy's concern is if we start saying rights are contingent upon having certain capacities, perhaps some ability to reason or process things, then if we start linking it to that, we then do run this risk of dehumanizing people that we instinctively feel should have the same rights as everyone else.
Right. So first of all, what I described was a series of different capacities, not any one or two. And so those capacities, I think, do encompass pretty much every human being, and then some. And I would also obviously exercise the cautionary principle here. So if human beings as a species are largely capable of these capacities, although not every member at all times are doing so, then I would say every human being is kind of in that grouping. But again, it's a challenging question, and I'm doing my best to answer it. But on the other hand, what about the challenge I'm putting forward about more non-human animals being included, about AI being included, about aliens being included. I mean, how does a Christian even approach that? Is it even possible? If you believe that Jesus' death on the cross gives these rights and to every human being, which admittedly is an evolution over what came before, where rights were, if there were rights, they were limited to people of particular group, culture, nation, what have you. So this was really universalizing things, and that was a great thing. But it kind of has to stop with humans, doesn't it? How do you extend it? Is that a concern that you would have?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I mean, I really appreciate your willingness to recognize it was a dramatic shift. And you know, one of my favorite sort of atheist thinkers on this, there's a French atheist writer called Luc Ferry, who wrote a wonderful book called A Brief History of Thought, which surveys the whole of kind of Western philosophy. And he's quite anti-Christian in places, but around human rights, he's very positive for just that reason. He says that we forget historically that really until Christianity came along. Exactly, you know, Aristotle and others, there really was a sense of some people have rights and the rest don't. And he said, I may not believe in Christianity, but I'm grateful to it. But I just want to pick up, to answer your question, Justin, pick up on something you said there to go. I want to be very careful here. It's not that I'm saying because of Jesus' death on the cross or some such thing, human beings have rights. I think the cross has a lot to say about human value, because if God values you and I so much that he would do what he did in the person of Jesus, that tells me, firstly, we're loved and we're valued. It also tells us there was something profoundly damaged about the human condition such that God would go to such lengths.
Yep.
Christianity and Judaism, I want to couple the two together here, have always based that on that right out of that Genesis idea, that it's in the very nature of how we're constructed, that there is the very nature of what it means to be human. When God created human life in his image, that meant that there is something ontologically, to use the philosophical language, in our very nature that's fundamentally different. I just want to raise a question back, though, if I may.
Well,
Justin, what do you want to ask?
I think there was one more point, though, that Justin wanted to push you on, which is this sense of...
Oh, yes.
He's saying, should we expand
the
circle? So if, say, artificial intelligence developed some consciousness, would that then acquire the kind of rights that Christianity has so far only ascribed to humans and so on?
Well, one of my questions there, of course, would be, we said earlier that rights and responsibilities go together. So if Siri ever achieves consciousness, she'll have a responsibility to actually get me to Starbucks correctly rather than, you know, some alley down the back of Abbotsford somewhere. So until that happens... But very seriously, I think that the question of expansion, this is why I think the rights and responsibilities piece is so important. Because actually, one of the things that's happened in this sort of sense that we feel we need to push rights out and include all kinds of things, other animals, a South American country, I think it was Brazil, was recently reported as contemplating it wanted to grant rights to rainforests because they wanted to stop deforestation. Justin's question about rights for AI, if ever we got machines that were self-aware, that comes out of this idea that unless something has a right, we can't protect it. I want to flip that on its head and say I don't think there's enough talk about responsibility. And Justin, you mentioned this right at the start, that if we think about it that way, that as human beings, yes, we have a certain set of rights that flow from value and dignity, but we also have a certain sense of responsibilities. And I'd be saying to the Brazilian government, I mean, you don't need to grant rights to rainforests. We have a responsibility out of being human. That means we should treat the natural world in a certain way. And I think that is how I'd begin to answer as a Christian philosopher things like the AI question, that if that ever happened, and I've got a background in computer science, so I am a little bit AI skeptical, but let's suppose that it were, then I would have a responsibility in terms of how I dealt with that particular entity. Not because it somehow magically acquires a certain set of rights, but because I have a responsibility that flows out of who I am. And that's a responsibility that affects how I treat the natural world, how I treat other human beings, how I treat animals, and so on and so forth. And I think there's been a little bit more sort of tendency in our culture to obsess on rights language without necessarily also looking at the responsibility and duty language as well. And I think we want to hold the two together.
I do agree. Historically, they have gone together.
Yeah. You wanted to, I mean, coming to the question of responsibilities and duties, I suppose the interesting question for me is, you obviously believe in this idea of universal human rights, Justin, flowing from the capacities that people have. How do you ground the duty that people have to respect that? How do we get to the oughtness, if you like, of morality, of the way we should treat other human beings? Because it's one thing to say, I believe everyone does have these particular ideas of dignity and equality inherent within them. It's another thing to say, and you should respect that. whether you're a Mao or a Hitler or some peace-loving person, what makes it the case that there's this oughtness about the nature of humanity?
Good question. I think if you look at the way the Declaration came about, this wasn't one nation imposing itself on other nations. Mm. This is a declaration that's been signed by just about every nation. This is a process that many different nations entered into to come up with this sort of consensus. There's a few names that I wanted to throw out there because I think it's instructive here just to prove that this wasn't just a Western imposition. Some of this was new to me as I was coming to understand the history of how the Declaration got created. So there was a Charles Habib Malik of Lebanon, who was a key author. P.G. Chang of China, these statesmen from different countries across Asia were extremely involved in setting this up. An Indian delegation was behind the rights of women, including that in the charter. An Egyptian delegation argued for its universality. A Pakistani delegation argued against child marriages. So this really was the pooling of resources, and to my earlier comment, different threads that were weaving throughout history in terms of different approaches to human rights, all sort of culminating in this document. So I think that does suggest a universality, that does make the whole concept of human rights something that once it's been enacted and everybody's kind of signed on to it, or all the nations at least have, that it's something that has now been legitimized at that international level.
But is it then simply, as long as the majority agree on something, that is what creates the moral sort of impetus, the oughtness of it? Because I suppose that obviously I'm guessing North Korea wasn't a signatory, for instance, to the... Does that mean that they just have to obey it because the majority agreed to it?
Well, I think, in a way, yeah. And, well, more than that. I mean, if you look at, let's say, for example, North Korea or any tyrannic country, the lack of human rights is what allows these countries to impose themselves on their people. The ability to appeal to an international body of human rights, to the international community, if you will, to international law, among other things, is what allows individuals in these countries to have some hope of arguing their case against these tyrannical governments. Not that in North Korea they have much of a chance to do that, but it does give some legitimacy to an individual in some far-flung corner in the world whose rights are being trampled by the government of his country. Where else would he go if if his sovereign government is sort of the be-all and end-all of law and right? Then there is no other place to appeal to. So I think it's really important that this be at the international level.
What do you make of this idea that universal agreement is what makes this morally binding on people to treat others in this way?
Well, I want to say a couple of things, actually. I'm noticing that Justin's answering every question with, that's a good question, and I'm starting everything saying, there's a couple of things I want to say. It's like pattern developing here, but there we go. I think I appreciate what some of Justin shared there. I mean, there was certainly a lot of people involved in that drawing together of the UDHR. But we also need to be careful also not to romanticize history. We need to remember that, of course, part of the impetus for the UDHR was what had happened, you know, obviously growing out of Europe, but with affecting the world more widely, with World War II. And at the end of World War II, something called the Nuremberg Trials happened. Mm-hmm. And the Nuremberg Trials were when many of the former German SS officers and Third Reich leaders were put on trial for crimes against humanity. That wasn't the language that was used, but that was effectively what was done. And what was interesting was almost every person who was put on trial for their actions during World War II tried the same defense. We were just following the laws of our country. We were just doing, you know, what was considered right by the standards of German society at the time. And it's the right thing to do to follow orders. It's the right thing to do to follow the law of your country. And the Nuremberg judges ruled to a man and to one woman, there was one woman on the panel, ruled that there are standards of behavior and rights and wrongs and ethics and duties and so forth that transcend countries. That it doesn't matter what the majority tell you to do. There are things above that, and that was really quite an impetus in what then moved into the formation period of the UDHR. But it's interesting that not every country did sign on. I mean, for example, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIEC countries, have their own version of the Human Rights Code with some particular changes. I mean,
those countries did sign the original.
They signed the original, and then, of course, they made changes around particularly the freedoms allowed to women and freedom of religion. And then, of course, even now there are countries that take a dim view on things like political association, such as China. And I remember that this Justin, had a very interesting conversation just a few weeks ago with university students at Aberdeen University in Scotland, where I just
done an event, and she came and talked to me, and she self-identified as a communist. And they're quite rare, which is interesting. So it was a fascinating conversation. But she also was an advocate for human rights. She was a big believer in human rights. Sort of interesting way these things combined. And during the conversation, I just gently shared with her. I said, well, you do realise that I think, you know, in my view at least, if there is no God, then really what you're espousing is a set of preferences. And you may be able to find a few other people to round up around you, but it's a set of preferences. So the question I put to you is, how can you go to other countries and other cultures and tell them they should abide by our preferences? And I think this is a huge issue, because even if it's something approaching the majority, you sort of run into the kind of problem that Friedrich Nietzsche raised, the absence of God. Really what it's about is how much power you can grab, and if you can grab enough power and wield enough influence, you can enforce your rights, your wrongs, your ideals as normative. But that doesn't make them right.
No.
It just makes you the bigger bully.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
You're listening to a live edition of the Unbelievable show, recorded at the Apologetics Canada conference recently in Abbotsford. And thanks again to Apologetics Canada for setting it all up and the excellent recording that took place there as well. And we'll hear Justin Trottier's response in the final part of the radio show coming up on the other side of a short break. If you can continue listening, though, via the podcast, you'll also hear the Q&A from the audience towards the end of today's programme. Be back in just a moment's time.
You are a leader, whether you realise it or not. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, Andy Peck gives lessons from the life of Christ on leading from wherever you are. Plus, the world's best-known Bible scholar, N.T. Wright, reveals the Apostle Paul you never knew. Tim and Rachel Hughes share their story of leading worship and an exciting new church plant in Birmingham. And as Hamilton makes its West End debut, find out how God shows up in the musical everyone wants to see. Ask for a free copy of the magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Welcome back to this week's edition of The Unbelievable Show, which aims to get you thinking and brings you conversations that matter every week, often between Christians and non-Christians. And we'll be returning to the final part of the live dialogue I recently hosted in Canada between Justin Trottier and Andy Bannister. And just a final reminder that Andy is one among a brilliant lineup of guests at this year's Unbelievable Conference in London, Saturday the 19th of May. Do make sure to get hold of your tickets. Tickets were flying out the door as our early bird closed on Friday this last week, but still some great deals on tickets if you want to check it out. And of course, look at the topics and various people who are engaged. Reasons to Believe scholars will be over from the USA engaging in this year's conference. And there's some exciting stuff to reveal as well in the run-up to the conference too. And some exclusive stuff at the conference that you'll be party to, including some sneak preview at our forthcoming Big Conversation series. So that's something to look forward to if you are coming to this year's conference. premier.org.uk/justask. Straight after today's programme here on Premier Christian Radio is The Profile. Dr. Nigel Cameron is a Christian expert on bioethics, but also artificial intelligence and robotics. Where's all that stuff going, you may ask? And how should Christians respond to some of the ethical challenges posed by artificial intelligence and robotics? Well, that's exactly what Nigel has written about in a new book, The Robots Are Coming, God, Them and Us. I'll be talking to him about his own life and ministry and how he's responding to the issues around artificial intelligence. That's on The Profile, 4 till 5, and on its own podcast. You're just looking for The Profile or wherever you get your podcasts from. Don't forget, you can get Unbelievable in its own right as a podcast as well, of course. Do rate us as well on iTunes if you get the chance, and spread the word about the programme. Always good to get new listeners on board. We've no feedback today to the programme as we're maxing it out with today's dialogue, but be interested to hear your feedback on today's guests and their topics and the way that they handle the conversation. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Equally, find us on Facebook and Twitter to send your thoughts there. At UnbelievableJB for the Twitter handle, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And if you can come back next week, we're going to be doing the programme that I promised you for this week but decided actually to hold off for one more week, which is that theological debate on, does Calvinism excuse sinners and make God guilty of evil? Guillaume Bignon and Paul Franks will be debating that from a Calvinist and libertarian perspective. Look out for that same time next week. Also got a very special show coming up for Easter Saturday as well, when Glenn Scrivener, another guest who will be joining me at this year's Unbelievable Unbelievable conference. We'll be engaging with an atheist guest on whether death is a tragedy for atheists and whether resurrection is a fantasy for Christians. So look out for that as well in your podcast feed or on your radio set around Easter weekend.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Okay, time for the final part of today's dialogue debate. If you want to also catch the Q&A that took place at this special Apologetics Canada conference dialogue event that we're airing today on Unbelievable, then do go to the podcast of the programme. But for now, Andy Bannister presses the question of whether general agreement on morality is enough to establish it as true. He said, having the power to impose your ideas doesn't make you right, it just makes you the bigger bully. Here he is, finishing up that thought, and Justin Trottier, our atheist guest on today's dialogue, will respond.
I think that's one of my questions around the universality of this, that even if you could theoretically get everyone to sign on, that doesn't make it necessarily right in that it's true. It simply means you've got enough people to sign on.
But Andy, that's a very good question, by the way.
There you go. And I'll say two things to you later.
And it's a question that I do want to address, because
yes.
I think what you've rather cleverly done, if you don't mind me saying, is you've taken the debate away from, it's okay that you've done this conversation about the foundation, whether it's better atheistically or an atheist foundation versus a Christian foundation, and now we're having an argument about universality of human rights as though it's only my burden to bear to answer that. But from a Christian point of view, how do you make any sense of it? The point of universalizing human rights was that it was something that would cross all creeds and religions. So if your claim, and maybe it's not your claim, but if your claim is we have to all accept the reality of Christian truth in order to find the right foundation for universality, then you have a whole other thing you have to do. You've got to get everybody to be a Christian, and then you've got to convince them that Christianity gets you to human rights. I'm not arguing that. I'm not saying you all have to be an atheist. I don't care if you are atheists
or not
atheists, you'll never become atheist. What I'm trying to do is ground this in the natural world, which we all agree exists, Christians and atheists alike. If we can do that, then we have the recipe for universality. If we all have to become Christian, then two-thirds of the world's not Christian. And you're not going to get 100% of the world to ever become Christian.
Do you have to be
so
a Christian to believe in the Christian foundation?
Let's follow the trend. I've just got a couple of things to say in regards to that.
I thought you would.
It's great. Absolutely, what I'm not saying, and I can only apologize if I've given that impression, is you have to believe in a Christian to have human rights. What I do believe, though, is that if the Christian story isn't true, a number of things go with it. And that's one reason why I often come back to someone like Nietzsche, because I believe that one of the reasons I admire him as a philosopher, I think he's one of the atheist philosophers who saw this the most clearly, that if there is no God, it's not just some minor fact about the universe has changed, a number of things have changed. One of them, and we may not have time to get on this in the dialogue now, but we can go into it in the Q&A if you like, because it's related. The whole idea of freedom and autonomy and self-determination, it's a huge question whether that can stand on naturalistic materialism, because we really are just a series of physical processes in the same way this, I think it's a log.
We can agree on that.
We agree it's a log. I think it's a sort of, sort of very rustic British Columbia computer. It's a log in.
Oh, dear.
But anyway,
you win.
Hey,
now stop.
Stick with the philosophy.
But let me stick with the philosophy very quickly. Yeah. Let me give you an illustration for what I'm trying to get at here, because I'm jet lagged. Illustrations I think help. And I used this one the other night, if any of you were there. Let's imagine Justin, perhaps all three of us, but Justin. Let's imagine
Justin B.
Justin B, because we live in the same country. Okay. Let's imagine that every week we go to the pub. And we have a beer or a Coke, if there are any Baptists in the room. No Baptists tonight. Fantastic. Bring it on. And we have a beer with a friend of ours. We see him every week. Let's call him Tom. We're good mates. And then one week we say to him, it's been great chatting with you tonight, Tom. We'll see. Our friend Tom, by the way, is a flat earther. This is to make the illustration work. And if you don't think this is serious, the flat earth community is growing. They're growing sort of sideways and outwards, not round, obviously. But Google, there's loads of them. I don't know where they're coming from. Anyway, Tom's a flat earther. We've tried to convince him, we can't otherwise. Anyway, we just finished having a beer one week with him, and we say, we'll see you next week, Tom, usual time. He goes, no, sorry, guys, I can't see you for the next couple of months. I'm going off on a round-the-world cruise. And we're like, what? You're a flat earther. What do you mean you're going on a round-the-world cruise? And he gets all upset and aggravated. And he said, how dare you? How dare you infringe my rights? How dare you tell me that people who believe in flat earth can't go on round the world cruises? How arrogant. How arrogant. What's going on in that conversation? What's going on in that conversation is you can believe in flat earth theory and you can cruise to Australia. The thing is, your flat earth theory can't sustain your cruising to Australia. You actually have to borrow from round earth theory in order to go round the world. Or if there's any flat earthers this evening, they'll probably come and nobble me afterwards and go, no, you're wrong, and this is why. And I think something, for me, is going on similar in this discussion around worldviews. I think absolutely, as a humanist, as an atheist, as a Buddhist, a Muslim, a Hindu, a Jedi, if there's any in the room tonight, you can believe in a whole series of things. You can believe in freedom. You can believe in consciousness. You can believe in mind. You can believe in inherent dignity. But I don't think your worldview has the resources to sustain those. So you don't need to be a Christian. But if Christianity isn't true, I don't think you, I, or anyone here has dignity.
So, of course, I would say pretty much the same thing, that just as you think I kind of borrow from the Christian worldview in order to ground, you know, we've had this debate many times, ground morality,
yes,
ground meaning, ground, what are we debating tonight? Oh, yeah, human rights.
Yeah, that's right.
Then I could just kind of make the same claim, right, that Christians are actually grounding their arguments for a foundation on the natural world, although they may be dressing it up a little bit differently.
Well, how so? Unflesh that.
But what I wanted to ask you, really want to come back on something here, because you mentioned that the Christian worldview must be true in order for there to be rights, right? In order for humans to have the dignity necessary to lay a foundation.
If they're not just
for
a fiction,
rights.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the historicity of Jesus dying on the cross, this is a historical event. It happened in a particular time and place. That's your claim. Before that, there was thousands and thousands of years of human history. I think by some estimates, there were 47 billion humans who lived and died before that temporal event took place. I guess what I'm wondering is, if it changed everything the way you're saying it did, then for 47 billion humans, they lived and died without value or meaning. And if an act happened before Jesus, if a murder happened before Jesus, well, it wasn't actually a moral crime because this act somehow created the dignity.
Is that what you're actually saying, Andy?
Well, first, I'll say a couple of things. It's not 47 billion. It's probably under a billion, actually, but your point still stands. Yeah, as Justin said, that's not what I'm saying, Justin. This is so confusing, Justin. What I'm saying is, but let me bring Jesus into it very briefly, since you raised JC to go with JB and JT. I'm saying, again, I bring you back to Genesis chapter 1. I'm saying when God created human beings, right at the very beginning, he imbued them with the image of God, and we can discuss exactly what that means, but the idea is that built into our very nature is that we have value, and we have dignity because of the way that God constructed us. So that was true before Jesus came along. However, what Jesus coming along demonstrated in the Christian tradition is the incredible love and value that God has for... I love it, amen, sorry. for each and every one of us. And just because up until that point, God hadn't done that tremendous act of sacrifice, doesn't mean God didn't love us any less. By analogy, if I was to get home from this trip, you know, on Tuesday, and my five-year-old daughter's playing out in the street, and I see, you know, one of the garbage trucks in our community that uses our street to practice for NASCAR driving, you know, roaring down the street, I run out of the door, and I throw my daughter out of the way, but get flattened by the garbage truck. And then some sort of philosophical clown comes along and says, oh, well, you know, Andy didn't really love his daughter for the first 5.5 years of her life. It was only, you know, today that he demonstrated love for her. There would be a misunderstanding. Because at that point, that was perhaps the most supreme revelation of my love for Katrina, in that Christians would say that when Jesus came and died on the cross, that was the supreme revelation.
I'm having a bit of trouble understanding that. I'm not trying to be facetious. I really am. If everything was already sort of there, in terms of how God created us in Genesis and all of that, and this was just an act of demonstration, then I still don't understand why you need a demonstration in order to confer meaning and value. And if it is just a demonstration, isn't it only those who were kind of witness to the demonstration or those who heard about it for whom this can have any kind of effect? Which means most people wouldn't have heard about it, you know, wouldn't have been affected by it in that demonstrable.
Yeah.
In that particular way. I won't even try to pronounce that.
If that's not a word, it should be.
Yes, thank you. It is tonight. For thousands of years until they heard the good news, as you might put it.
Well, again, I think we're slightly talking kind of past one another here. So to reiterate, the value that human beings have is kind of baked into who we are from the moment that God has made us. To be a human being is to bear the image of God and to have value and dignity. But of course, I mean, what's so exciting about your question? I'm being so careful because I don't want to start preaching. This is a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And in all seriousness, actually, you know, I said this the other night, and I don't say this to be flippant. You know, I'm hugely grateful, Justin, that you're willing to come and have dialogues like this, because I know it isn't easy, because we've done these things in mixed audiences. This really is not a mixed audience. So, there may be a few Anglicans in the room, but, you know. But the thing about the cross, of course, that's so exciting, and this does actually tie in very much, actually, to the human rights discussion, although we may have time to explore this in huge detail, is, of course, One of the reasons why human rights and all this dialogue is necessary is human beings are very strange animals. We have the ability to do great good, and we have the ability to do great evil. And humans have this issue that in our nature there is something sort of fundamentally twisted. Now, if you're a Christian, you can use the term sin. If you're an atheist like John Gray, you can just say we're a messed up animal. But we can all pretty much universally agree that if you just open the newspaper, you can see there's a problem. And so, as you're aware, because you've hung around Christians enough, that the Christian story, of course, is what's happening on the cross, is God actually doing something about that problem of our broken nature, which is why we have all these problems in the first place. But it flows out of the value that God's placed upon us. And it wasn't suddenly that God started valuing human beings differently sometime around about
83. Well, the sinful nature of humans, that was always my understanding of why it was necessary for God to sacrifice Jesus on the cross. But I thought that was to repair the broken relationship between man and God, this issue of sin and salvation, rather than just make any kind of statement about the human relationship with other humans, which is, of course, what human rights is really about.
But it does, right? Because it does two things. Well, it's interesting here. I mean, it's fascinating we're talking about Jesus, right? Because, I mean, Jesus was famously asked, you know, which is the greatest law in the Old Testament? And, of course, you know, if you know your Judaism, you know the hundreds of the darn things. And Jesus, I always like the answer because I think it must be like with a twinkle in his eye. Like any good philosopher or theologian, he was asked to give one answer and he gave two. So, I mean, good company when I say I. And Jesus said two things. He said, love God and love your neighbor. Why did he put those two together? Because if you love God, it tells you who you are. And in order to love other people, you actually need to know who you are. You need to be secure in your identity. You need to know what it means to be human. And then, of course, but then that flows outwards into loving the person next to you. We can only love the person next to you if you know they have value and dignity and are worth inherently more than just a very nice kind of wooden table. So those things go together. But God's actions in what he did in the person of Jesus on the cross, you know, God didn't, in the person of Jesus, die for, you know, aardvarks or tables or lettuces or eggplants. It was human beings showing in that action the value that he placed upon us. So it is this demonstration.
We love other people as a way of showing our devotion to God or as an end in and of itself?
I think it's both and. And Christian ethics, one of the things that I always found fascinating about Christian ethics compared to, not every, because that's unfair, but certainly many other ethical systems, is that Christian ethics, when understood properly, is a lived response in gratitude. It says, look at what Jesus has done for me and be so incredibly overwhelmed with gratitude and wonder for that would change how I view others. And of course, the other thing as well that I think flows out of this human rights discussion we're having tonight is, of course, one of the things we tend to do as human beings is divide each other into groups, them and us. And one of the things that generates that is superiority. If I think I'm better than you because I have a British accent or less hair, I don't think that, because not merely, there's another man with a British accent here and that cuts through that.
And more hair.
If I think I'm superior, and more hair.
I'm actually the unique one on the stage.
But if you can think of yourself in a way that's superior, you're quite a way down the line to dividing people into them and ours and treating those who are not like you abhorrently. And I think one of the things that certainly for me that was profound in the Christian worldview and encountering Jesus was the gospel is actually, when you take it seriously, cuts you down to size because it tells you that you aren't something.
We've had a really good discussion. I'm aware we're only 5 minutes or so away from having to start to wrap things up. I know. And you've asked a lot of questions here of trying to make sense of Andy's view as a Christian of human rights. I wonder if there could be some questions in the opposite direction in the last few minutes. In as much as I think you started to lay out some idea of how humanism or atheism better grounds, if you like, for you the idea of human rights than Christianity does. So just putting that question to you, I think Andy's criticism is, it's very difficult to see how we can have this sense of intrinsic human rights if actually it all really boils down to preferences. You know, we happen to have developed this particular view under this particular constitution of a document. But in what sense does an atheistic worldview actually enable you to say, yes, and this does apply to everyone absolutely across all places and times?
Well, similar to what I was saying earlier, the mere fact that a human rights truth is discovered, or I don't want to use that word, is reasoned in one particular place and time doesn't mean that it doesn't have validity universally. I think earlier I mentioned the example of mathematical or scientific truths, which can be discovered in, again, certain places and times, but other people can readily understand that there is a rational reason to believe that that's true. I think the same can be said of human rights and of morality generally, that we can arrive at those truths locally, if you will, but then we can argue them through the power of rationality, which is something that we all share, and then we can make our case to other people.
What's your problem with this particular way of arriving at a grounding of these human rights?
Well, I think I said a couple of things. What's interesting is how easily one slips into normative language, because your analogy there, Justin, of mathematical truths and scientific truths, of course, those things are out there to be discovered. You know, we don't invent the law of gravity. We go out and we experiment and we observe and go, oh, it's out there, it's external to us. And it doesn't matter if every single one of us in the world doesn't believe it, but it's still true. And so I guess my question to you would be, yeah, let me turn that around and go, does the same apply to perhaps human rights theory? Let's imagine that the majority of people don't believe in human rights, which actually was the situation for the majority of human history, that actually, you know, people generally were incredibly tribal and really, you know, sort of respect went no more than your kinship group. But let's suppose that the majority of people don't believe in human rights. Let's perhaps we do a mass hypnotism experiment. You know, philosophers love thought experiments, and we convince everyone, you know, just to be sort of, you know, sort of cold-hearted and, you know, distant and remote, and just like Justin as a moderator. Does that change reality, or would you still say, no, I don't care. I don't care if I can't convince anybody, if I'm the only person on the planet, only me, Justin Trottier, who believes that humans have value and dignity and we should behave a certain way. Does that make your belief false, or is it true even if nobody believes it to be true? Yeah,
it's not a Platonic truth in the set, which, so the analogy, it's not a perfect analogy, of course. I'm not saying that human rights or moral truths are in that sense objective, that they exist out there in the universe, that if humans didn't exist, I think I said this earlier, that they would still be true. I think we need for there to be human beings, for there to be human rights,
all agree on those rights, I suppose, is Andy's question. If no one believed in it except for you,
yeah,
would it still be true?
I think that there are certain ones that are generally agreeable across the human family, and then there are others that are more debatable. And where I would draw the line is those freedoms and rights that are sort of the minimal requirements in order for us to be able to even engage in this kind of debate about human rights. We would need to agree on those at least. Otherwise, we'd be limiting our ability to explore the universe and to find truth. So things like freedom of thought, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, I think those would be what I would call the basic human rights. That if we don't even have those, then we can't even really get off the ground.
I still think, whether it's I haven't done a good job in communicating it or you're doing a very good job in sort of dancing around it, probably the former. But if it's that you are the only person who's convinced about this, I mean, let me give you let's take a real-world example rather than a thought experiment. It's very interesting that for the majority of human history, every human civilization practiced slavery. You know, the Europeans have had it in the neck because of what we did in terms of slavery, quite rightly so. But the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Chinese, the Arabs, the indigenous peoples here in North America practiced it on one another. Every civilization that anthropologists know of has practiced slavery. So does that mean until we arrived at sort of modern human rights and the idea that that behavior is wrong, was it okay? Was Aristotle all right? Was Aristotle perfectly moral to say it's okay for slavery? No. Some people are born to be slaves. Or was he wrong then, even though everyone agreed with him?
Yes, of course he was wrong then. But the Bible didn't overturn slavery.
Well, I'm not saying it did. What I'm trying to get into is are these this human dignity and the things that flow from it, are they external to us, or are they just a set of preferences, whether it's yours, the three of us, or a wider group? That's the question.
Yeah, and I think that's a challenging question for equally for both of us, because I don't think you can... I don't think that there is any clear answer to, for example, the slavery question from the Bible. If anything, the Bible seems to support slavery. So some Christians use those references to continue to support this horrifying institution, and other Christians, like Martin Luther King, of course, is a great example, use his religiosity to oppose slavery.
But aside from all of that, back then, was slavery okay if everyone agreed with it?
No.
But then I think that, as you say, I think that's a profound challenge.
But that it is a challenge, but it's an equal challenge to all of
us.
But
you've been challenging me for the evening, so I'm now turning the favor on you. From your perspective,
that's fine. But if you're trying to suggest that that's a challenge that's unique to an atheist, to an atheistic worldview, I think that's kind of unfair. It's a challenge to come to a decision on a whole panoply of moral questions, regardless of the tradition that we're in. Again, I don't see that Christianity has a toehold on that particular question or other questions
like
that.
Very happy to give my perspective.
Capital punishment, for example.
Very happy to give my
We can have a debate about capital punishment.
But let's not go there because we're already over time.
But the point is that there are so many questions that within the Christian tradition, there is no clear-cut answer because the Bible can be interpreted in different ways.
I'll just give you both a chance just to sum up what we've heard so far this evening, because we do have to go to a break, and I need to give people a chance to gather their thoughts and
send their questions in.
Andy, just 30 seconds and then...
30 seconds? I can't do anything in Justin 30 seconds, the... Justin, but there we go. I think what I want to do in my 30 seconds is just bring it down to the questions that we already began with. To me, it all hinges on, does the person sitting next to you this evening have intrinsic value, intrinsic dignity? They would have that if nobody else believed it. They would have it irregardless of time or space, irregardless of their abilities. And then one has to ask yourself the question, does that flow more naturally from the Christian idea, the biblical claim that we're made in the image of God? And that's actually the answer to that challenge Justin raised. That yes, there's hard work to do in Christian ethics, but it flows out of what is it to be a human? Which is why I think the first question on the Human Project is brilliant. What is human? We need to answer that question. What does it mean to be a human being? Or can you fit that on the idea that we are nothing more than atoms and particles governed by the same laws of physics and chemistry and biology and nothing else as govern the water cooling in our mugs or the wooden tables here on the podium? I think that's the question that everything else flows from. What does it mean to be human, and do we have value and dignity?
I would just say that I think the natural worldview that I'm trying to espouse tonight is the one that is more open, that is more future-oriented, that when we do, for example, encounter alien intelligence or we create AI, we're going to be able to tackle those questions because we don't presuppose that we have to embrace one particular creed or that we have to limit human rights to those who either look like us or share our religion. And I really kind of haven't seen a good argument put forward on the other side tonight, that Christianity, which was groundbreaking at the time and did expand that circle of rights and protections to all of humans, that it has any ability to go beyond that. The natural worldview that I'm espousing, it's a challenge to answer these questions, but it is the only way forward if we're going to find a way for us to have a solid foundation for human rights that doesn't depend on any one particular creed or religious tradition. And if universal human rights, that concept universality, is at all meaningful, it means we have to find a common framework that can cut across all religious traditions. So not an easy thing to do for any of us here, but if we can find a way to do it through an understanding and a commitment to the natural world, which all of us, I think, agree exists, I hope most of us do, then we're on much solid footing to have a truly universal approach to these questions.
Let's give a round of applause to both Justin and Andy.
You've been listening to a special edition of The Unbelievable Show today, recorded live at the Apologetics Canada Conference recently, a dialogue between humanist Justin Trottier and Christian Andy Bannister on the Foundation for Human Rights. And you're listening to the podcast edition of the programme, which means that you're going to hear the Q&A that took place shortly after a quick break at this year's conference. So keep listening. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
What is holding you back in your faith? Do you take 3 steps forwards? 2 steps back? Are you questioning how science and Christianity fit together? you're not alone. Christian or skeptic, whatever your doubts or questions, whatever stage you're at, we believe that we have sound scientific arguments for Christianity. Through concise and straightforward facts about faith and science, we can help you reaffirm your faith and spread the Christian gospel with confidence that Christianity and science come from one source, God. Find out more at Reasons to Believe. Visit reasons.org. That's reasons.org. Reasons to Believe, where science and faith converge.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So final part of today's podcast edition of Unbelievable, as we hear the final Q&A section that took place, which included both written comments and questions from the audience and people coming up to the microphone to ask their questions. This was all part of the Apologetics Canada conference. Do check out Apologetics Canada if you can online. Some fantastic resources, including a special project they launched at this year's conference, the Human Project. Very impressive. Some fantastic videos and resources around that. All around the question of what it means to be human. So that was obviously the inspiration as well for this particular dialogue on the Foundation for Human Rights. Again, do check out Apologetics Canada, some great resources from them. So here's the final Q&A in the dialogue that took place at the conference.
All right, so one of my questions was, during the conversation, the moral... looked like it sounded like the moral apex was humanity, or that humanity was the moral authority of the universe currently. So currently that humans have the highest moral values over, let's say, cows. But given enough time with something like AI, or as Friedrich Nietzsche was kind of mentioned a couple of times, the Übermensch, or the evolved kind of human, or a different type of being that would evolve into having higher abilities, either in cognitive areas or in whatever categorical areas you think a more virtuous system would occur, wouldn't that then make us cows? Wouldn't we be to the Übermensch or this superior AI what cows are to what we are right now?
That's interesting. Mm.
So could we become a lesser species in the sense if another species, if we had aliens maybe who came along?
Yeah, and is there anything wrong with that?
Okay.
Just talking from a naturalistic point.
Let's hear
point.
From Justin first and then see what Andy has to say.
Well, I was going
to
mention the alien response that other Justin here preempted. Because, of course, I mean, we may be living in a universe where there are other intelligences out there, and I think... I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I think a majority of humans, when polled, consistently say they believe that to be the case, that we're not alone. And it's likely that if we were to encounter other intelligent beings, that they would be far, in a way, more advanced cognitively. Now, I get, or with respect to their intelligence, but the question is in terms of their moral value as persons, and I would use persons differently from humans. We're humans, but we're both persons, us and these aliens, whether that makes a difference. And I would go back to what I said earlier. Any being that is capable of self-determination, of autonomous actions, any being that can bear, in a meaningful sense, responsibility for the choices that they make, again, back to the rights and responsibility conversation that Andy and I had, would equally be deserving of human rights protection. So I would accord it to us. I would accord it to these other beings.
Would that be like... well, then, I'm sure your shoes would be made of leather. Would then it be okay if we were made of the finest kind of boot qualities of this Übermensch or anything like that? Because we don't have any better
Is there
rights,
some sense or? In which the fact that they're far more cognitively superior, in some sense, makes us less valuable in comparison?
Any being that has the minimal standards is deserving of the same rights and protections.
Well,
I'm misunderstanding
the
question.
Respond there, because...
Yeah, well, very quickly, I mean, I think the question you raise is actually very, very, one that's taken very, very seriously in ethics, and it's got a fun term. The term that's used in ethical theory is utility monster.
So a utility monster is something that has the ability and the right, just because it's, you know, so much more superior, to use another species for its benefit. So human beings are the utility monsters of cows and other members of the animal kingdom. Now, we could talk about we want to treat them fairly and kindly, but nevertheless, we are the utility monsters. And the problem goes, that I think you're raising at, is along comes, you know, E.T., you know, sort of zips here out of a black hole, and it's not so much about whether, you know, Justin, we go, oh, welcome, E.T., we grant you human rights. It's E.T. looks at us and goes, fantastic, I am your utility monster, and I have all kinds of things I want to use you for as human beings, and if, you know, rights and whatever you want to term it is simply a case of ability, and that creature is so much more capable than us, then, you know, all bets are off. And the AI question raises the same thing. And of course, what's interesting is science fiction, I think, explores a lot of this. One of the reasons why I think it's fun to read sci-fi is you can, you know, sci-fi explores these kinds of ideas. And what does happen if we generate an AI that is so far beyond anything we can imagine, and it looks at us and goes, yeah, thanks, lads and lasses. But
you sound like you want to make
a quick response, and then we'll move on to the point of view is kind of being caricaturized here. I mean, I've never said that it's whoever is the most intelligent that is the only bearer of rights. I'm saying any species, and I'm the one who wants to expand the rights to more species, not you know,
but I'm
reserve
them
for us
them.
Or whoever. Yeah, or wants to restrict them to us or the next most intelligent aliens that we happen to encounter. Anybody who is capable of having these capacities.
This keys into another question. I'm going to say thank you for your question at this point. This one came in from the audience on text. And the question is, Justin, could you elaborate more on how rights flow from capacities? Because I think that's something we never quite got to in the conversation is, okay, you've acknowledged we all have, you know, anyone who has these particular capacities to self-determination, to sentience, to self-awareness and so on, has these rights. But the question is, how do those rights flow from such capacities? How do you link them intrinsically to these capacities?
That's where the connection between rights and responsibilities is critical. Because by having the same capacities that give us rights protections also makes us able to enter meaningfully into relationships with other people and to bear responsibility to those other people and to be held accountable if we violate their rights. So I agree with Andy very much on this point that you cannot tear apart rights and responsibilities. Together, they are what make us capable of entering into these kinds of relationships with other human beings.
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, very quickly. I think we're still ultimately the issue here. There's some things that unite us. I think one of the things that does actually fundamentally divide us is I think we're still basically on preference. And it's interesting, the dialogue we had the other night, Ian, who for a lot of the evening took a similar tack to Justin, then went in a slightly different direction and said at the end, actually said, I have to admit, I'm a relativist. But I think, in a sense, it's okay for Justin, for you to say, yeah, I believe that these things lead to the following. I think the difficulty is somebody turns around and goes, that's lovely for you, but you're right, your values can go jump because I have the power and the ability. I don't need to listen to you. And, of course, you know, he's turned up several times this evening. Friedrich Nietzsche's comment about, he didn't use the language of human rights because he was earlier than that, but he said when people say, you know, you should behave this way, his answer was, that's just the weak using that kind of language to get the strong to do what they want. But actually, if you have the strength and if you have the power, you can do what you like, you can make the rules. And I think you have, the struggle is, can we get beyond personal preference?
We'll go to another question from here, yes.
Hi, my name is Glenn McDonald. I'm one of those atheist listeners to your show, and I'm thrilled to be here to see this in person.
Thank you for listening.
Welcome.
Gentlemen, you were both fantastic and eloquent, and I'm really grateful to be here tonight. So,
thanks for coming.
Andy, we heard you argue tonight that naturalism as of grounding leads to kind of a subjective grounding for human value.
Yes.
And you seemed unhappy with that or unsatisfied by that.
Yep.
If the Bible is to be believed, on Christian theism, God is the grounding for human value, right? But by definition, that's subjective, right? The subject, a subject, God, a person, three persons, one person, however you want to split that up, but a person is of the opinion that human beings, his creations in his image, have value. Right, so that is a subjective belief. And we also know from the Bible, if it is to be believed, that this God sometimes changes his mind. And in a pertinent example, he repented that he had made all these humans in his image and he drowned them all to death, right? So if it's true that our value is subjective to God's belief and that he does change his mind on things at times, How does that provide a stronger foundation than naturalism?
That's a really good question.
Thank you for the question.
And thank you for that. And again, really appreciate you kind of coming. I'd say a couple of things. I mean, I think it's interesting. Let's begin where you angled in on the question of subjectivity. I think it sounds like you sort of recognized the problem, because it's looked like you were kind of sort of running a variation of it's a problem, but you've got the same problem. It's particularly a problem, of course, for if we live in an atheistic reality, and all we have are human subjects, and of course we have 8 billion human subjects right now, all of whom have different preferences, and of course how dare you tell somebody else that your preference wins? Or as somebody put it to me once, they said, you know, human rights, they claimed, is a Western invention, and you guys are simply being imperialistic. You know, you British people did it then, you're doing it now, trying to tell us, and I won't tell you which country it was, how we should or shouldn't behave. In the case of God, of course, if God exists, and of course I believe that he does, Justin hasn't yet convinced me otherwise. If God exists, then of course we're not just talking about, you know, just another subject or even a slightly bigger version of us. That can sometimes be the mistake people fall into about God. God is like a sort of rather large, he's like us, but just a little bigger. God is the one who underpins the whole of reality. God is the ultimate it. God is the ground of being, to use the language of philosophers. And the reason that gives us the foundation is it's God is the one who calls every atom, every particle, whether it's making up a table, a chair, or you or I, into reality. And it's therefore that fact that we have that value, we have that dignity, ontologically, to use that word, meaning, you know, nature, that we have those inalienable rights, is because of that's the way that God has constituted us. So to be a human being is to be a bearer of value and dignity and rights and so forth. Now, I don't want to go too far down the flood thing, because we're trying to keep the answer short. But what I would say is this. One of the things that's interesting is it's actually because human life matters that, of course, things like justice matter and why God takes things so seriously. If God merely overlooked human inhumanity to other human beings, and went, ah, you know what, I don't care. I mean, Hitler was a nice guy, mousy tongue. He was lovely, you know, he had a kitten. We go, what kind of God are you? Because if human life really matters, then injustice is a very, very, very serious thing. And God takes that very, very seriously. Ultimately, so seriously, and we talked about this earlier, that God stepped into history in the person of Jesus.
That raises the question of whether God could have acted any differently, right? But I want to pick up on a couple of other things here, Justin. If, as you say, God is the creator of the universe, the ground of being, if we're subjects that have been sort of created by this deity, then, man, that would kind of concern me, actually. I would see us as almost like playthings, part of his divine plan, rather than subjects, rather than ends in and of ourself. That the question of whether or not in that kind of framework we have moral worth, as Immanuel Kant would say, as ends in and of ourself, whether that's consistent with the idea that God has ordained all of this, he set this in motion, and he also has a plan, and we're just kind of filling in the pieces as actors on a stage. When you and I have talked about questions of ethics before, and we've had this debate before as well, but I think it's relevant to the question that was asked, which is that if God is the one kind of calling the shots, deciding what's right and wrong, why should we follow it? I think that kind of gets to the question that was asked. Why are we compelled to follow those commandments? Is it just arbitrary commandments that we have to follow because he is so much bigger and more powerful than we are?
I think, as you've asked a couple of questions, we'll let
Andy
respond.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm aware we don't want to just start the dialogue and there's people waiting, but let me try and briefly say a couple of things. On the first point you made at the start of your... Remind me the first point I wanted to angle in on.
Which is the question of... what was the first point?
God's plan for humans.
Are we just play things? Absolutely. What's interesting is I'd say two things very briefly here. I think the Bible is very clear that's far from who we are. Again, I bring you back to the incarnation, because to go the value that God demonstrates there in the cross is astronomical, is almost infinite, really, the value God demonstrates. But here's the interesting thing. We were talking about this the other night, a few of us, that to go, I know for many of my secular humanist friends, freedom and autonomy are a big thing. This idea of going, I don't want to be controlled by God. I want to be, you know, self-determining and so on and so forth. I just want to gently say, if naturalism is true, you do not have that. You are nothing more than a plaything of the laws of physics and chemistry and biology. The reason you're thinking as you are now is because of your brain chemistry. What's going on in your brain now is a result of the previous brain states and the previous brain states. You can't escape from that world of causality, which is why so many atheists and atheist philosophers are increasingly arguing for determinism. What I would say, if God exists, the God of Christian theism exists, God has the ability to actually grant you genuine freedom and genuine moral choice to be made, because physicalism is not the only game in town. But if it is, you are not free.
Well, this gets
free.
Us into a very big debate about how an immaterial being can have...
I think we'll have to leave that one there. I think the second question, if you do want to address it quickly,
yes.
Andy, was a form of the Euthyphro dilemma, yes. I think, where if God commands things, do we follow them because they're the right thing? Well, then in that case, do we need God to command them in the first place?
Yeah, what was interesting, actually, again, we're rehearsing some of where we went the other night. What I think is fascinating about the Euthyphro dilemma, for those who aren't familiar with it, let me recapitulate it very quickly. It's the idea that, does God command things because they're good? In which case goodness is a standard outside God, or are things good because God commands them, in which case God could command me to poke, visiting...
It makes morality arbitrary.
Yes, God commands me to poke Justin Brierley in the eye, and that's a good thing. Of course, the same thing applies to everything. It applies to society, for example. Are the laws that the society determines good because good is external, or are they just good because society determines them? And it sort of collapses inwards. In the case of God, and certainly the God of the Bible, the understanding that Christians have always had from the beginning is that it's actually neither of those options, that God is goodness. God is love. God is beauty in his very, very character. And then what God commands and acts flows out of that. And that's always been the Christian answer from the very beginning. And nobody really in philosophy of religion takes you through that seriously.
I'm going to move the question because we must take some more questions. So let's have another one from this side on this microphone. Yes.
Thanks very much. Tom Rogers here, and another question for Justin T. And that is, what would it take to convince you that God does exist? Would the right science...
Which God?
The creator that put us together.
So what... Okay, great question.
The Christian God or the Muslim God or...
Yeah.
What would it take to convince you, Justin, that God exists? Yep. You've asked, well, which God... Well, let's just say a creator of the universe... Let's say, is there
well, any... Well, hold on a second. I mean, the God that's often imagined by Judeo-Christian monotheists has certain attributes that I don't even think are logically coherent, right? So first, you'd have to explain how a God can be at the same time omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. I don't think that's a coherent... Those three things even fit together logically. So we've got to start with that.
We could prove that.
You've got to come up with some kind of formulation that can reconcile the inconsistencies inherent.
So for you, it's rather attributes. That you find the actual idea of the Judeo-Christian God inconsistent. Do you want to respond to that, Andy, yourself?
Yeah, I'd be very, very careful, because the question was asked of Justin, and it'd be very, very unfair for me to say, well, the real reason Justin isn't a believer is for these things. So I'd be very careful not to even remotely go there. But I would say this. I think when it comes to evidence, human beings can be quite interesting in the way we approach evidence. For example, we can be surrounded by evidence and overlook it. Really good example from science, for example, is smoking. Everybody knows that smoking causes cancer, but my sister continues to smoke. She can justify herself in the light of evidence. And I think as human beings, we're very good at justifying ourselves in the light of evidence. Now, of course, if atheism is true, Christians are guilty of that. But if Christianity is true, atheists are guilty of that. But it's interesting, one or two atheists have made interesting remarks around this. So Thomas Nagel, very famous American atheist, once wrote this in a book he published, I think it was 1986, in the View from Nowhere, I think was where he writes this. He says, it's not that I don't believe in God, it's that I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. And the one thing I would say is this, nobody is neutral on the God question. There's no Switzerland of the mind. Mm-hmm. Nobody is neutral on the God question. And the question is, as we approach the evidence and have these conversations, can we be self-aware enough to recognize that, both on either side of this conversation this evening?
There's lots of things for which there is plenty of evidence, but people don't believe it. At the risk of making some enemies here, I would include evolution in that category.
Well, let's move on from that can of worms to...
Can of worms. But the worms may become something in due course. So,
I've got two questions here that came in on the text and SMS and so on. I think that are essentially the same question. So let me ask them both here, good. And they're aimed at you this time, Andy.
Oh, good. Okay.
What do you do with the archaic laws that seem to oppress the rights of women? And similarly, Christianity has been used to violate many human rights. What do we do with that? So given the history of Christianity, in some respects, and archaic laws, perhaps that people see in the Bible, maybe, that have oppressed the rights of women, I think this goes back to Justin's question in the debate.
Yeah.
How does Christianity, in any sense, ground us
exactly.
if we've got these kinds of issues?
I think so. And I think what I'm very conscious of in that question, and I think I alluded to this earlier, I think both atheists and Christians, but obviously I'm answering as a Christian for this, need to be very cognizant of our history. I think all of us actually have things in our history that are embarrassing, and Christians certainly do. I mean, one of the examples for me that I often reflect on in this is the Crusades. Which concerns me deeply because my academic study was in Islam. My PhD is in Quranic studies. I have many, many Muslim friends. I've had dialogues with hundreds, thousands of Muslims in the last 20 years or so. And I look back at history and what Christians did in the Muslim world in the name of Christianity. You know, whichever clown it was had the idea of painting the cross, a symbol of love and forgiveness, on military hardware. I mean, where did that ever come from? And I can only look at that and wince. What I would say is interesting. When we critique Christian history, and when we critique how Christians have behaved, the question I always want to ask is, what is the standard that we're holding people to? What we're doing is we're drawing them back to Jesus Christ and saying, you're not being Christ-like. The interesting question is on the other side, when someone holds to a different worldview, to what can you hold them and say you should have behaved otherwise? So take a Joseph Stalin. I am not putting him in Justin's camp. Be very careful here. That's not what I'm doing. We can label him however we want to. But what would you say to a Joseph Stalin on his deathbed? To say, Joseph, I want you to consider what you've done. How should you live differently, given his, you know, his communistic belief system? Let's just leave it at that. The answer is you can hold him to nothing. And so I find it interesting when we critique Christians in history, and we should certainly do that. We shouldn't duck that question. It's Jesus that we're drawing.
Do you want to make a brief comment as well on that, Justin?
The only thing I would say is I would just point to the fact that the person who thinks the opposite of you on a given subject matter can easily make the exact same argument you just made, can easily point to the same tradition, the same biblical injunctions. They may find different parts of the Bible that back them up. I just don't see the difference. The Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda thinks that they're doing God's work by butchering people in the name of God. And that's happening in the modern world.
Well, I'd say a couple of things there very quickly. One, of course, if you push that to its logical conclusion, you've just argued full-blown relativism. You can do whatever you want and claim it on anything else. The same goes true for atheism. You can behave abhorrently and say, well, I'm doing this because I believe that, you know...
Of course you can, but it's not a feature in your worldview.
No. But then let me say something else here that I think is often missed. The example you made, not just now, but earlier, let's just talk about for a minute, which is we look at slavery and the way that some Christians, you know, use the Bible to justify slavery.
Yeah.
What's interesting... And this fascinates me because Wilberforce is one of my areas of interest and having read extensively on that period. Scholars who've looked at that in detail would say it is pretty darn clear that those who claim to be using the Bible to justify slavery were merely thrashing around trying to counter scriptural arguments coming from the other side. This is demonstrated by the fact the very same people who were arguing for slavery using the Bible argued for something else. People are unaware that Wilberforce fought other campaigns. One of the campaigns he fought was to allow British missionaries to distribute the Bible in the Indian India, which is then part of the British Empire, in the Indian languages. Many of the same people who campaigned for slavery were trying to get the Bible outlawed in India. Why? The argument literally went, and you can read this in Hansard, in the records of the British Parliament, the argument was, the last thing we need are the Indian natives getting it into their heads. They are made in the image of God, and they are equal to the white man. That will be a disaster.
That's a good example of a section of the Bible that supports an anti-slavery position, but there's plenty that support it.
But my point being,
that support slavery,
that those who are using the Bible...
Injunctions where slaves are told to obey their masters, what do you say, that God got it wrong in those sections?
What higher authority can you invoke? Well, we're jumping track here, Justin. I'm making the argument...
You brought up the slavery issue.
Yeah, what I'm making from... Let me keep you on one argument. I'm making the argument. It's very easy to go, oh, yes, look, Christians used the Bible to justify something when actually they didn't. It was a mere flag of convenience. On the Bible...
and slavery. Let me say a couple of things. And again, I don't want to go down the slavery route, but let's address it. One of the huge mistakes that's made is people compare what was going on in terms of the ancient world and slavery with what the European powers and the Arabs actually did in Africa, because the Arab slave trade was even bigger than the Western slave trade. In the Bible, largely what we have is indentured slavery, where if you were poor, if you had no ability of earning an income, if you had no land, you could sell yourself into slavery. And if you read the Old Testament, that's why you have that law structure.
That's not the only time there was slavery. God compelled the Hebrews to conquer other peoples and to put them into slavery against their will.
You have to look at what the institution of slavery was in the ancient world. And rather than have a debate now around what it was or it wasn't, I recommend the book to people.
But Andy, you brought up slavery that it was a simple matter of reading into the Bible that it was anti-slavery, and it's not. Well, you have to make the case based on non-biblical,
we're going to have to
that
draw
is to
this,
say, secular argument.
Debate. Yeah, he needs to read Wilberforce.
Let's assume that we're going to agree to disagree on that one. Would you like to come and ask a question? We've just probably got time for a couple more questions before we have to draw.
Hey, my name's Cody.
Hey, Cody.
And can I just say I'm so psyched to see Justin Brierley here. Like, I'm a bigger fan
Of that's
JB than the other
Thank
one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Answer
it. My question's for JT.
JT.
So clearly we've been flirting with this idea that you can't really ground your moral epistemology in something objective, right? And you've been kind of like hard to pin down throughout the dialogue about where you actually place it. It seems as though you ground it in something like rationality and consciousness, or conscience, sorry. Is that right?
That's one part of it, sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what I'm saying, or what my question is how would you justify moral epistemic duties? So moral duties that involve sort of assenting to a certain true proposition, right? So you ought to believe what is in fact the case, regardless of sort of pragmatic utilities and things like that. Now, notice that you can't appeal to your own rationality in order to justify these beliefs, because then you'd be arguing in a circle, right? And so how would you ground these beliefs? And
that's quite a complex question, but I think what you're getting at is why should we aim for truth always,
right?
Given that that's not necessarily something that...
Some philosophers have pointed out, like Alvin Plantinga, for example, says that some things have a sort of such a high epistemic status that you just find yourselves with those beliefs, like they just sort of appear. You don't choose to believe in them.
Right.
But that's certainly not true for moral beliefs or scientific beliefs even.
Yep. Well, so, let's just see what Justin has to say in response to
this. I have nothing to say. I don't understand the question. Yeah. I'm sorry. Can you give me an example?
It's a great question.
Yeah, so basically when when confronted with enough evidence... where you would make the inference to general relativity. Say, you're confronted with this sort of cosmic phenomena that would give you reason to believe general relativity is true, right?
That's not exactly the way science works, but go on.
Well, I'm just saying, why would you be under any sort of moral obligation to believe in that in general relativity rather than just withhold belief or just refuse belief?
Well, that's not how science works. So in science, there's falsification. We come up with a theory. We try to make predictions about how certain events should play out if the theory is correct. Right. And then we try to falsify the theory based on whether those predictions actually bear out.
Right. I think what the question is, if I'm not mistaken, is the question of, is there some moral imperative to aim for truth, even if it may not be particularly beneficial to us either way, but that we should believe things that are true rather than things that are simply advantageous to us, for instance? Because I think the questioner is suggesting that that is at some level difficult for a worldview where we're just evolved to believe in things that are advantageous fundamentally rather than in things that are true. This may be taking us beyond the remit of...
That's a great question. Okay.
Yeah, let's
get at it.
Andy, you say something about it, and then we'll just see if Justin has something to say in response. And we're going to have to wrap
I don't know how that's... Why are you addressing it to me? I mean, why is that an issue for atheists any more than anybody else?
Andy, you sound like
you want to get in on this.
Let's have some fun.
I'm going to ask you both to keep it really short, because we are going to have to wrap things up now.
So... Well, here's one of the reasons. There's a couple of reasons why it's a really interesting question. Firstly, many atheist biologists have pointed out that if we just have naturalism, then really where truth fits into that is quite problematic. So Patricia Churchland is my favourite quotation on this. She's an atheist biologist, and she said, "Look, the nervous system really is only concerned with the four Fs." Feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproducing. And, you call yourself a Christian audience. And then she ends that quote by saying, truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. In other words, quite frankly, evolution doesn't care about truth. It simply cares that you can escape from threats, eat, and pass on your DNA. And there's lots of people in her camp. That's actually probably one of the majority position, actually, in neurobiology. So that's the first issue of going, where does this sort of pursuit of truth come from? But the other place it goes, and I'll just throw this out, and then see if Justin wants to say anything. One of the things I think we've done is we've in 21st century Western culture, at least, we've separated truth and goodness. Plato, so I'm not going for a Christian now, I'm going for, you know, going for a Greek philosopher, put those two together. He said that actually it is virtuous, it is good to think after what is true, and it is immoral and it is wrong to think that which is false. And he had a whole sort of essay unpacking that. And I think he's right. But of course he based that on his conception of God, which is God is the good, capital D, capital G. And I would certainly say as a Christian philosopher, I want to go, yes, because if God is the source of all truth, then actually it is virtuous to think about what is true, and it is actually immoral to think about what is false. And say Plato and others have jammed those together. We've ripped them apart.
Let's just allow a quick response from Justin, sure. And then we're going to draw this to a close.
If God is the creator of everything and the ground of being, why I still don't see why I should care unless I make the decision to care. So everything still comes from human agency and human choice. Whether you're a Christian who decides that you're going to kind of go along with God's plan and sort of be bound by the rules God has set, or you're an atheist who still finds yourself with the same capacities for self-determination, autonomous decision-making, all the things that I've been repeating a few times here, at some point it's still a decision that you as a human being have to make. It's the same issue with God kind of commanding you to do good. Well, that's a fine thing for him to do, but unless you decide to do good, you're not actually acting ethically. So I think the reason I was a bit confused before was I just didn't understand how this is a challenge for only one side of this debate. We're all human beings with the same capacities, and we all have to make a decision. If we're Christians, we might decide that we believe God commands us to do a certain set of things, and we're going to do it, and that's how those actions of ours get to have ethical worth. If we just do them because God commanded us to do it, there is no ethical worth in those actions.
My sincere apologies to everyone who's waiting at the microphones, but we are going to have to call it a day there. Perhaps Andy and Justin can make themselves available on the floor. But for the moment, can I have another round of applause for both our guests this evening?
Thanks for being with me on this week's edition of Unbelievable. Do tell your friends about the programme. It was fantastic to meet so many unbelievable listeners, both Christian and non-Christian, at the Apologetics Canada conference. So thanks to those great guys out there for the opportunity to go out, speak at the conference, be involved, and also to visit the beautiful Vancouver area as well. If you want to get in touch with the show again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to send your emails to. And don't forget to book in for the British version of what Apologetics Canada do, the Unbelievable Conference, coming Saturday, the 19th of May. Fantastic variety of speakers, including, of course, Andy Bannister, who you heard on today's programme. Looking forward to that immensely. premier.org.uk/justask. For the moment, thanks for being with me on today's programme. Let me tell you what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
Held off this theological discussion for another week, but we will be airing that programme. Does Calvinism excuse sinners and make God guilty of evil? My guests will be Guillaume Bignon and Paul Franks. Now, they're both Christians in this case, but very different views on God's sovereignty and what the implications are for Calvinism when it comes to free will, morality, whether we're responsible for the things we do, if on Calvinism God has sort of determined everything that we actually do. How does Guillaume Bignon, who is himself a convert from atheism to Christianity, square that particular theological circle? You'll find out on next week's programme as Paul Franks responds from a more Arminian-Wesleyan sort of free will perspective. So looking forward to that for the moment. Thanks for being with me on today's special extended edition of the programme for podcast. And see you again at the same time next week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.